You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks.
You are listening to New Mexico Filmworks, brought to you courtesy of Hutton Broadcasting on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. And later in the show, we are going to have John Armijo, but in the studio today, we have Janet Davidson, no stranger to the film industry in New Mexico, or California for that matter, I imagine. Janet practically had to remove the IV from her arm to get here today, and really appreciate you coming in. Janet has a career both as an actor, assistant director, director, is known as one of the first steadily working female assistant directors in episodic television. She's a founding member of New Mexico.
Okay, I am actually the four of us that founded New Mexico Women in Film. And I ended up being the founding president for 4 years.
Well, welcome and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, before we get into, tell us a little more about your background.
I grew up in New York City, and I grew up wanting nothing more than to act. So I had the fortune of growing up in New York City, so I had the fortune of being able to go to professional acting schools right away. And after high school, I went to professional acting schools and then saw the handwriting on the wall on how difficult that was actually going to be to make a career. And I'm not someone who really likes difficult things, I think. So although it broke my heart and it's all I ever wanted, I did give it up. And then by some miracle of whatever, I ended up on the other side of the cameras and just worked my way up until I was producing and then finally assistant director. And then directing in L.A.
But the acting thing is not very far from you. You teach acting?
I teach acting, and I used to have a producer that I worked for, and people would say to him, well, when did you give up acting, Janet? And he would laugh and say, give it up. You know, I'm quite sure that you cannot be a good director unless you actually act too. Because half the time when you go up to an actor to ask them to redo something or to give them a comment or anything, quite often you have to figure out what acting venue to take to talk to them and how to approach them. And every time you're in front of the crew, you have to even as an assistant director too, you have to really judge what that crew is going to respond to. And that's an acting job. And as I say to all the acting kids, the kids that I studied with, have you ever lied? And if you've ever lied, and don't tell me anybody hasn't lied, then you're an actor.
What is it that you have gotten out of acting? What does it do for you?
Observation, I would say. And it's the one thing I really try to ask anybody who comes to study with me on any level. We have to be so attuned to really look around us. And it's a great joy because I remember as a kid, I was always just so interested in what was going on. I was just always looking out the window of the car and looking at people and sitting around. And when other people were busy tying their shoes or something, I just remember sitting and watching people. I was fascinated by people. Fascinated by the different tics they had when they walked and talked and what in the world can make. I've said very often that a good actor and a good director really has to take a psychology course because you have to really understand what makes the human being. To portray the human being in all aspects and ones that you're not familiar with yourself but actually are deep inside yourself, you have to understand the psychology of the human soul and the human being. And that is fascinating to me. I hope I never lose my interest in what's out there. If I do, then I think that that's pretty much the end.
Is there a particular kind of character that you find difficult or too foreign? Or
for me personally?
Yeah.
I don't know. I doubt that I could act anymore, but I don't really know. I think the New Mexico, interestingly enough, I think the New Mexico actor, in general, and this is certainly a generalization, has trouble with anger.
Oh.
I think it's a, first of all, I don't think it's, I think there are certain cultures that repress showing anger. And when that repression happens, it becomes too big. So sometimes you have these massive explosions of anger, which are not daily anger.
Right.
Daily annoyance, daily things where when you take the lid off of it daily, it doesn't burn up that way. And so I find that there, that in general is something, and that may well be for people in general, because they, to let go of that much, it means that people might think less of you because somehow you have that anger and hatred inside of you. And that becomes difficult, I think, for people.
Mm-hmm. So how many psychology courses did you take?
I grew up in the streets in New York City. That was it.
Yeah, right. Street learning.
That subway ride back and forth to school kind of did it.
Right. And the television work you did, was that in New York or California?
I started in New York doing commercials. And then by the time I was producing, they sent me to L.A. I think I was at about 27 at the time. And the plane landed in Los Angeles, and I just said, oh, my God, I'm home. Uh-huh. It just felt amazing to me. So I finagled my way to actually move out there. And then we had, at that time, there was the beginnings of the Women's Steering Committee in the Directors Guild of America. And I had gotten into the Directors Guild that was another just complete miracle, because sometimes you fight and fight and fight to get something, and then you kind of give up, and all of a sudden it's in your lap, and that really literally fell in my lap. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up, because I've always been not particularly frightened of speaking in front of people and everything like that.
That's an asset.
So it is an asset. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you get your wrist slipped, you know. But so I became chair of the Women's Steering Committee, which was newly formed at the Directors Guild. And at that time, a group of women right in front of me had put together a lawsuit that the Directors Guild took on. And I think I've told this story. The Directors Guild sued all the producers on behalf of women and minorities for us to work.
Right.
And it went to the California Supreme Court, and the California Supreme Court denied it, citing that the Directors Guild was equally reprehensible and equally responsible. Directors hire assistant directors and on down the line, so that they had to clean their own house first. So what the Directors Guild did at that point was and we were arbitrated, the Supreme Court put it into arbitration, and we had to meet personally with the producers, and it was just a sight. Somebody should have made a movie about it. Here were all of these wannabe either directors or assistant directors like myself on one side of the room with the Directors Guild lawyers. On the other side of the room were the producers' lawyers and all of these producers. And every other week we would meet with a different set of producers. And finally we met, because I was an assistant director at the time, finally we met with the assistant director group. And there were five of them, including the famous Abby Singer. And nobody said anything. And finally they said, oh, so we see there's no problem with assistant directors. We can move on. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. Because everybody else had promised me they were going to talk, and I didn't have to talk this time. So the next day, so I laid out the problems of employment of assistant directors. And the next day, in the next 2 days, I think I got five different offers from five studios.
Oh.
And they were very interesting, because when I went to fulfill some of the offers, you could tell that the next in line did not want me there. One guy looked at my resume for 15 minutes and finally said, oh, I see you live in the Valley. Wouldn't you rather work in the Valley? And that was the end of that. So I finally accepted a job, and it was from Abby Singer. And then we had a big strike, which didn't really happen. And then Abby promoted me more, and suddenly I was first AD on Remington Steel.
Wonderful. One of the first regularly working women in the industry.
Right. As an assistant director, because there was only a handful in front of me. And then after that, and the bottom line is you had to fulfill, you had to be good. I mean, they weren't just going to keep you around because you weren't good. So I had to really work hard, and I made it my doing and my effort to really only hire women behind me mm-hmm. or minorities behind me. And unless I was given a second AD somewhere, I treated them fairly to right. a degree. No, I didn't. it worked out that I just really went from one show to another until I got onto Cagney and Lacey. And in Cagney and Lacey was quite a revelation for me, and that's where I first combined the acting with the directing. And it's the last time I ever acted, also, was on a Cagney and Lacey. And then they gave me my own episode to direct, and it really changed a lot of things for me, and the show itself, too. I mean, I learned so much from those women.
From
Tyne and Sharon.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting, and to have kind of that moment, that period when you have realizations and kind of life changes for you.
Yeah. Of course, you don't usually know them while you're in them. You're usually spitting and cursing the whole way.
Right. All right, we're talking with Janet Davidson. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and we'll be back in just a few moments. And we're back with New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC. I am your host, by the way, Dirk Norris. I'll be doing this show 3 days a month, and Toby will be doing the show once a month. So I hope you guys enjoy this. And by the way, send us an email. Let us know what if we're doing anything right, if we're doing anything wrong. Send an email to info@nmfilm.com and just put radio show in the subject matter or the subject line, and just send us a note. So we have Janet Davidson in the studio with us today, and we were talking about your experiences on Cagney and Lacey, and that was kind of an experience that changed your life a bit. So you have become would advocate for women in film be an appropriate word?
I think an advocate for women, period, you know, and I think that film is just a remarkable, as so happens that that's the outlet that I understand, mm-hmm. so that's the one that comes easier for me to get into. And it's really kind of grown because I'm now vice president of Women in Film International, mm-hmm. and in the international conversations, it is just so amazing to find the similarities that women in India have with women in New Zealand, with women here, and everybody
saying, just in general or
in general. Or, I mean, they're varying degrees mm-hmm. of what they certainly American women do not in general at all, hopefully go through with a lot of women in India or Saudi Arabia sure. or any of these countries. But the fact that Saudi Arabia has a budding women in film chapter with 150 people,
oh, terrific.
Women involved. Now, these are, they operate at the behest of the king. And if the king one day decides, no, you're not going to operate, well, that's what happens. And who yeah. knows what happens to their hands and their heads.
Yeah.
But this is where the emerging films to really depict what is happening in the home. Because what happens in the home spills out into the street and spills out into the streets of the world. And if you can't really clean up the home, then I don't know what hope you have really for the world in general.
Right. And are these women restricted in the kinds of films they can be involved in? could they do a documentary about the issues?
Yes and no. Yeah. I mean, I think they could do it. Whether or not they could actually show it anywhere, okay. Yeah, right. I'm not sure, you know, but they're courageous women who, you know, and the other thing is that, you know, Saudi Arabia has one of the most vibrant film festivals around. Mm. They're very aware of what international film, they have started, United Emirates has started co-producing films with Hollywood. Uh-huh. So there is an emerging newness to their realization of that there can be money and that there can be statue and definite things. And they love their film festivals because they love all the hoopla. And
right,
I shouldn't say they. I mean, but that seems to be what they enjoy. There we go again.
They, yeah. Well, just film is a medium that kind of lends itself to raising people's awareness about all kinds of things. And certainly the internet and things like YouTube change countries. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it really, and also it can spread lies and deception faster than anything else.
Well, that's true too.
And it can spread wildfire kind of disruption at the same time. It's a very, and certainly when it started, only a few people had the foresight to really kind of realize what film, the potential of film. And it certainly went towards the financial potential first. Mm-hmm. That's something that we have coming up that I'm actually so proud of, finally, is there's a film called The Lost Garden, which is the story of Alice Guy Blanchet. And Alice Guy Blanchet is credited as being the first female filmmaker. However, many people credit her as being the first narrative filmmaker. She was in France. She was a secretary for Grammont, and she asked if she could take the camera out one day. At that point, only the men were putting the camera on sticks or whatever and letting people pass through, and mm-hmm. that was movies. She said she thought she could make a little story out of it.
Right.
So she asked if she could have the camera, and Grammont said, "You can have it as long as it doesn't interrupt with your secretarial work."
Right.
So she took it out after that, and she made the Cabbage Patch dolls, believe it or not, and the Cabbage Patch Kids, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And this is credited as being the first narrative story done on film. And so there's this wonderful documentary, The Lost Garden, and I have been trying to get this shown legally in the country for a long time. The Canadian Film Board did this film, and the director and I, Marquis Lepage, were working steadfastly because they had lost the rights to the film, the Canadian Film Board. And in losing the rights, Grammont was going to charge a fortune to get, because there was all this historical footage in it. And
Right. They
just didn't have the money, and no one was going to have that money. And then out of the blue, about 8 months ago, I got an email from the Canadian Film Board and said, "Guess what? We got the rights back. You can have the film."
Excellent.
So what I started doing then was we bought them up. We bought enough up at a great price from them. They were very generous. And we have sold them now to our chapters throughout the world. The UK and Canada bought them directly from the film board. But we now are able to show. So we'll be showing it here in conjunction with the New Mexico chapter of Women in the Arts, which I am also on the board.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be showing that June 24th at Tipton Hall.
Wonderful.
And after that, if there's any way, because I'm quite sure it'll be filled, if I can get the film down to UNM and get the film, I will, because it's so important for young female filmmakers to realize how they were not alone. This woman in the 1800s had this desire to make films, and she made 1,500 films, and they're mostly gone. She had the first studio. She had Solex Studios in New Jersey.
Does having that example set for women, it really has that big of an impact?
Yes, I have seen where it's been shown. Where it has been shown before, I have seen women, including myself, I cry every time I see it.
Mm.
I just cry because for so long you're told it's not your job. It's not your job, and you have to fight for it. When it was our job, and because women are storytellers. People are storytellers in general. But women tell a different story quite often.
Right.
And to be told it's not yours, and then, oh my God, it was ours until money got involved.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as the studio moved to Hollywood and the New York money machine realized there was money in film, then she was destroyed, literally destroyed.
Yeah.
And she and two other females, who Lois Weber, who had in the studios also, they were all destroyed. And I mean to the deathbed destroyed.
Wow. That kind of stifling effect on creativity is just it's sad to see. It's bad. You're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we'll be back in just a minute. Back, and you're listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and we have Janet Davidson with us here in the studio having a lovely conversation. Janet, at some point you came to New Mexico.
Well, I had, that would be in the 80s. I was sent here on a location scout, you know, in the early, maybe even the 70s, the late 70s, to find a mountain that we could throw a Toyota off of. So they asked me to go up to Taos and look to see, and I said, well, no, that's not really going to work. It's going to plop into the parking lot. But it was my first time here, and I fell in love with it. I just thought it was amazing, and it's just ironic because I had a PA in L.A., Stan, and Stan and his wife Bev had moved here and created a business, Southwest Creating, and So I visited them, and they just loved it so much, and blah blah. So I bought a second home here, and I went back and forth, and then after the earthquake, I moved here full time, and did Earth 2 for a year, the year it was here, and then when that show went away, and it was clear that nothing else was coming in, I moved back to L.A.
That story of the land of entrapment, it's just a common one. Get here and say, wow, this is a place for me.
Yeah. and then you go, and every once in a while what happens, I think, with anything, it's not just because, remember, I loved L.A. and I still love L.A.
Yeah.
Is that you have to take that day to remind yourself about why it is you like, because in the middle of griping about Santa Fe and New Mexico, I'll suddenly look up and go, oh, how pretty. Oh, I forgot. Oh, yeah, I have to remind myself.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to take anything for granted. It's a little off topic, but for the last 17 years, I've been living in the middle of the desert, and it's beautiful and it's wonderful, and I never want to go ho-hum another sunset. But there are some things lacking in the middle of the desert, like, you know, movie theaters and mm-hmm. restaurants that you can get something besides a burger and a burrito. So it's nice to be here in Santa Fe. New Mexico Women in Film, and you recently had a workshop. And tell us about that.
I had a fundraising directing workshop, and it was on Saturday. And I was it was well attended, and I think it went very, very well. We will continue with them. Because everybody asked for a series of them, so I will put together a series for this. I had some gals from UNM and some gals from Northern New Mexico University College, and some from the SUFED, whatever we call that now.
Yeah, Art and Design.
Art and Design. And it was very exciting to see these young women who really wanted to learn and who really were for the first time thinking, well, maybe I could do this. You know, maybe I could do this on not just a let me grab a camera and make a film level.
And the workshop was for women filmmakers?
Women filmmakers. I really do believe, I'm a firm believer of that you can't know enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to be a director, then you really have to know acting. If you really want to be an actor, you have to know a little bit about directing. Just why do so many really of our great really good directors right now, and in the past too, Clint Eastwood, people like that, mm-hmm. come from the acting world.
Right.
Because you really, after you get to know the technology of directing, which you do by being on the set so much, then you begin to realize, no, wait a minute, I can combine the technology with my acting world and really produce something here. There are some directors which are purely technical directors. I mean, it's not that they're not good. James Cameron is a phenomenal director, what he does. Mm-hmm. And he probably is a damn good actor, too. But that's not how he started. He started in the technical world. So it was something that I really enjoyed. I really enjoyed hearing the questions, watching them start to think about things, and emphasizing also that if they were choosing this as a career, they were, and I do this in the acting workshops too, they're choosing a way of life. This is not something that you can just suddenly say, oh, you know, I can, especially acting, I can kind of abuse my body this week and eat what I want to eat. And no, you can't. You even if you're not working, if you're serious about it, you got to keep yourself in top notch. And here I am sitting there like this. Sorry. Yeah. But at least it happened after the workshop. And that's really, so I'm heartened by that. And I'm heartened by the young women that wanted to come along and want to continue.
That's wonderful. And were these women already filmmakers?
They were in the media department. What happened was the Directors Guild sent the trainee rep. You know, the Directors Guild has a wonderful trainee program and assistant director trainee program. And I can't say enough for being an assistant director. It's a great career. At a certain point, it becomes too hard as you get older because it's so demanding.
Really demanding.
So
yeah.
Demanding. So they had sent, and I knew she was coming to town, so I asked her if she would just put up a flyer. Well, she did more. She really encouraged everybody to come. So that's how they arrived, and that's how Northern New Mexico arrived. And then Chris had put up a flyer at Art and Design, so that's how that happened. So I really am very grateful for that, and I talk up the trainee program. Boy, it's an amazing process if you can get into it.
It's really wonderful that these opportunities are available to folks.
Yeah, they really are.
So let's talk about this documentary that's
yes.
coming up. You're going to be showing that, is it this Saturday?
It's the 12th. And what happened with this is this how ironies happen. When the Canadian Film Board finally released the Alice Guy Blanchet, they also said to me, we have another film we'd really like you to take, and that's Bone, Wind, Fire. And Bone, the Bone part is, of course, George O'Keefe. And I was just overwhelmed at that point because I just was in the midst of producing the International Short Showcase for the second time and getting that DVD out to everybody. So I said, you know, I just can't take anything else on right now. And then out of the blue, a couple of months ago, I got an email from the film board saying, we have a screening set up at the screen in Santa Fe, and here's all the parties, because Dr. Sharon Udall is going to speak afterwards, because mm-hmm. this is based on her book.
Right.
And so I said, oh, okay. And so then suddenly I am like kind of, and I'm thrilled to be introducing Sharon on the 12th, and she'll talk about her the book and everything. And then on the 20th, New Mexico Women in Film here in Santa Fe, we're going to do it. Is going to have a documentary workshop. And she is going to be with us, along with some of our other really great local documentary filmmakers. And I don't want to make a mistake here. So we've got Dr. Sharon Udall. We've got Jillian Spitzmiller, who was a wonderful teacher and had done Shakespeare in Behind Bars. Diana Taylor, who, oh, my God, I've been trying to get Diana Taylor for so long to stay in one place and do something. She is the most amazing cinematographer and has done so many documentaries. So she said, I can't believe it, Janet, I'm going to be there. And I said, oh, great, great. And Talia Victoria Koch, who's a wonderful lawyer who has New Mexico Lawyers for the Arts and has given so much time to 501, she'll be there to talk about the business part of documentaries. And that's really what it's called. It's called the business of documentaries, which I almost wanted to add a question mark on the end of it. Or is there a business of documentaries?
I've been talking to people lately about the business end of filmmaking and how much experience filmmakers have in the business end and finding out how much is involved in that. But it's also a matter of how can you make any money off a documentary? What kind of a living could you make off of a documentary?
Very little.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, it's a passion. It's a point of passion. I had a documentary. I also like to say that Lynn Hamrick, if she's available, will be on the group too. Mm-hmm. I had a documentary that I pulled around for a couple of years, and I spent I had an allotted amount of money that I was going to spend. And once I got to that amount and no one else was putting money in, then I said, no matter how much I love this, no matter how good this is, I have to stop because there are certain practical things. And I think that's one of the things. With the availability of camera right now, and camera is so easy, way too many people think, in fact, I can make a movie. And if they're bereft of anything but their own personal, this is a story I love, then they go after these documentaries. And then their life is spent touring around with the documentaries. I don't regret the money I spent. I was trying to do the women and children of the Black Panther Party.
Mm,
and I don't regret my business partner, Chief of Staff of the Black Panthers, meeting him, David Hilliard, and signing up with him and meeting all those wonderful people. Don't regret it, but I have to look at it as a hobby and at this point. And right. I think if we're willing to look at certain things as a hobby, that's one thing. But if you're thinking you're doing it professionally, then you have to have a business plan before you go into it.
And so the workshop is on the 20th?
That workshop is the 20th. It's going to be out at Aldea. We have a Facebook page, Women in New Mexico Women in Film. If you're not a member of us, you can just log on and find out when. And it's a nominal cost for non-members, or you can join up.
And you also have a webpage, nmwif.com?
Uh-huh. Yes, we do.
Okay,
yes,
terrific.
We do. Mm-hmm.
So people can find out information. And can anybody sign up for these workshops?
Anybody can sign up for the workshops, absolutely. This is this one. And then the 24th, we have the screening in Tipton Hall. And then in July, we'll be bringing back the International Showcase to really talk about the making of short films, so that when New Mexico enters again next October, they'll have another winner.
Wonderful. Well, I thank you so much for coming in today and answering all these questions and speaking, and it's greatly appreciated.
And I didn't cough. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You're still alive. You've been listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we'll be back with John Armijo in just a minute. Back with New Mexico Filmworks. My name is Dirk Norris, your host today on Talk 1260 KTRC. And we've got John Armijo, a film historian, on the phone. John, how are you doing?
Pretty good, Dirk.
Good. So what do you have for us today?
Well, today we'll visit Native American lands, the various pueblos and the Jicarilla and Mescalero Apache tribes that between them have been the location site for over 200 film and television productions. Because there are so many films to cover, we'll call this part one. And for all your information out there, there are 11 southern pueblos, 8 northern pueblos. The Navajo Nation is spread across San Juan County and McKinley County, which encompasses the Dena Zin Wilderness, the Bisti Badlands, Angel Peak, and other exotic locales. The Jicarillas are up north in Dulce, and the Mescaleros are down south in Otero County. Although the Jicarillas have only hosted two films, in 1971, they were a major investor in the Kirk Douglas Johnny Cash feature film A Gunfight, which was filmed at the J.W. Eaves Movie Ranch. Their total investment was $2 million, and I was told by one of their tribal leaders that they made out pretty darn good. No doubt adding to the box office cachet were co-stars Jane Alexander, Karen Black, Keith Carradine, and Raph Vallone. the British-made TV docudrama Warrior Woman Lozen employed Mescalero tribal members to play all the main characters. Lozen, a Chiricahua Apache, rode and fought alongside Geronimo. The narrator was Lucy Lawless. Here is a snippet of her introduction to Lozen. As a young girl, Lozen decided that tidying up the tent and cooking buffalo stew was not for her, and she was in constant trouble for beating up her brother, the mighty Apache warrior, Victorio. Now, there's a movie. Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, also filmed at Mescalero. Surviving Columbus, directed by Diane Reyna of Taos Pueblo, won the 1993 George Foster Peabody Award and the 1994 Ohio State Awards. Filming was done at the Pueblos of Acoma, Santa Clara, San Juan, and Taos. Sorcerer, directed by William Friedkin, is the only feature that we know about that was allowed to film on sacred Navajo ground at Angel Peak. Sorcerer was a remake of the French film Wages of War, which, by the way, is currently playing at CCA here in Santa Fe. Only two films that I know of have filmed at Kit Carson's Cave on the Navajo Reservation, the 1930 version of Billy the Kid and The Prodigal Planet in 1982. Laguna Pueblo was the location for two classic films, The Grapes of Wrath and the Kirk Douglas masterpiece Ace in the Hole, which also was also released as The Big Carnival. Had it not been for New Mexico Governor R.C. Dillon and the New Mexico State Highway Department, Redskin, released in 1929, would not have filmed here at all. The reason was Paramount needed a passable road between Canyon de Chelly and the middle of the Navajo Reservation to transport their cast and crew of 150 and all their supplies to a New Mexico location that was 90 miles from Gallup. The Highway Department also built a road to Acoma Pueblo that facilitated the filming in a second location. And they built two bridges. One of them was in Acoma Valley, south of Laguna, and filming also took place in Albuquerque and at White Sands National Monument. In 1973, David Margolis, the film archivist for the state of New Mexico, interviewed Alice Duffy, an eyewitness to the filming of Redskin, as to her experience of being on the set atop Acoma Pueblo. Amongst her many recollections was this one. Richard Dix, the star of the film, would get ready for a scene by listening to the song The End of a Perfect Day, which was performed by someone playing a hand organ. Isleta Pueblo is a familiar sight in two TV series, In Plain Sight and Breaking Bad. In Plain Sight, also filmed at Hemis Pueblo. The movie Flap, starring Anthony Quinn, was adapted from Claire Huffaker's novel Nobody Loves a Drunken Indian. The studio suggested they keep the same title as the book, but when it hit the Albuquerque newspapers, all hell broke loose. So the title was changed to Nobody Loves Flapping Eagle, which was offensive in its own way. So they dropped the Nobody Loves part and settled on just Flapping Eagle. But Anthony Quinn didn't want to be called Flapping Anything, so he suggested the more dignified title, The Last Warrior, which also didn't fly, no pun intended. And finally, they settled on the nonsensical title, Flap. Filming was done at the Pueblos of Santa Clara and Santo Domingo, and they filmed in Albuquerque, Madrid, Santa Fe, and Truchas. Okay, Dirk, it's time to name the cowboy's horse and the name of his sidekick's horse.
Oh, God. All right, John.
Red Rider.
Red Rider. I have no idea, John.
Blackjack.
Blackjack.
Little Beaver.
Sorry.
Papoose.
Okay. Yeah.
Dirk, remember the TV series Mr. Ed?
Certainly.
Well, Rocky Lane, who played Red Rider, was the voice of Mr. Ed, the talking horse.
Oh, there we go.
So that about wraps it up.
John, thank you so much.
You bet.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. John Armijo, our film historian extraordinaire. You can find us, the New Mexico Film Office, at filmnm.com. And we now have links on that site to the podcast that you can also find on santafe.com of this broadcast. The show's streaming 11 o'clock on Saturdays, KTRC Talk 1260 Radio. And we also have a Facebook page. We're getting some more information up on there. You can find us on Facebook. A couple of the events coming up soon. As Janet said earlier in the show, Bone, Wind, and Fire is going to be showing at the screen on May 12th at 7 o'clock. New Mexico Women in Film is having a documentary workshop on May 20th. The film office is going to be in California on June 15th and 16th at the AFCI trade show, talking up New Mexico as a location for all these movies. And July 13th, the film office is having our annual liaison film meeting up at Los Luceros. So stop by. I might also suggest if you're cruising around on Facebook, check out Film Las Cruces. Those guys have been doing a lot of stuff recently. And getting really involved in the film industry. So I think that's about it for now. We, again, welcome your comments. Send me an email, info@nmfilm.com. Put radio show in the subject line. And just let us know what you think about the show. If you have any suggestions, let us know. You've been listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we'll catch you next week.